We're talking about a series of interviews in New York Magazine called What It's Like. The series tells the stories of people who live on the margins of experience, people who have unusual phobias or conditions, like someone who lives in constant fear of vomiting or someone who only has to sleep for 3 or 4 hours a night.
Alexa Suli Ray is with us to talk about the series. She conducted all of the interviews. She's a reporter for New York Magazine. Alexa, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, of course. No problem.
So what led you into this? Why did you start doing these interviews with people with such unique life experiences?
So we launched our new blog last year, Signs of Us. And I think initially one of the things that we'd sort of been thinking about doing was we wanted to find new ways to think about and tell stories about the sorts of things that, you know, scientists or social scientists were, you know, researching. Maybe there hadn't really been a way in which those sort of stories had been pulled together in a narrative sense. So we're wanting to do responsible science journalism, but we didn't want to, you know, wait for years to assemble a large sample size and, sort of present a kind of, you know, quantitative account of these, you know, sort of unique or cutting edge or just plain kind of, you know, misunderstood or ignored conditions or syndromes. In the magazine as well, at the same time, we'd been experimenting, I think, a lot with long-form interviews, mostly with famous people. And then also thinking about the sorts of interviews that were going on online. Reddit's Ask Me Anything, I think, were a big inspiration in terms of the, you know, these kinds of real sort of, you know, in-depth sort of, you know, say anything interviews with ordinary people. And so that kind of just all mixed together and then this was born as a result.
When you said not finding large sample sizes, I mean, in a lot of cases, these are such almost unique conditions. It's impossible. There isn't a large sample size of people with this. What kind of stories were you looking for? What kind of unique or rare experiences were you looking for to include in this?
Sure, and that's really true. And I suppose the sort of one of the main aims was to give people space to really sort of talk through, sort of like the microprocesses of their everyday life, and how this, you know, one thing impacts them, and give them the space to do that, you know, in as much vivid detail as possible. What were the stories we wanted to tell, as I said before, I guess ones that, you know, hadn't really been told or were misunderstood, but I think also really importantly, ones that sort of touch on universal themes. So, you know, I mean, you might not be someone who only needs 3 hours sleep. You might not have a genetic deviation that means you only need 3 hours sleep, but a lot of people can relate to, there might be people who have insomnia or who have stress in their relationships because they have different sleep patterns to their partner or, you know, have to juggle a lot of things during the day. The same thing, I guess, with a phobia. It's, you know, a lot of people might not, you know, be completely consumed with this fear of vomiting, but they might, you know, have other obsessions or anxieties. And then again, I guess, you know, there's another layer. It sort of touches on, you know, sort of more universal themes to do with, you know, the things that have actually happened to people in their lives that may or may not have caused these conditions or have, you know, come about as a result of leading these unique lives. So I guess those were the kinds of, you know, we were looking, you know, when I was seeking out subjects, those sorts of themes at the back of my mind. But, you know, they almost always sort of came up organically during the interview process.
I want to dig into a couple of the stories you focused on. One person, this was amazing to me, a person with superhuman memory,
right.
Something called Highly Superior Autobiographical Memory.
Right, or HSAM. Yeah.
So tell us what this is and how it affects his everyday life.
So the really interesting thing about this, it's, you know, something I think it was only discovered in about 2012, very recently, you know, within the last few years. And it's a unique form of sort of memory recall. It's not like, you know, like, I mean, not that photographic memory actually exists, but it's not as though people who have this ability to vividly recall, you know, every single little detail that's happened in their life, or they can't memorize things that well necessarily, but they really can't let go of emotions that are and memories that are tied to their emotions. So everyday events are so loaded for them and they're unable to forget them. So they might not be able to, you know, speed study for a test and, you know, memorize, I don't know, like a table of elements or something overnight, but they could sit down and tell you exactly what they were doing or they were wearing, or maybe not what they were wearing, but how they were feeling, you know, going back to any given date.
So this person could say something like,
fascinating.
Like on February 12th of 1997, I remember this event and how I felt about it in incredible detail.
Mm-hmm.
And even this, even though this isn't something that I have, obviously, it made me think, I wonder how many famous novelists might have had this condition.
No, absolutely.
That was the kind of detail he had.
Yeah, and also the sort of ability to read into situations with so much emotion, or events are so emotionally loaded. And I think you're right, and I think it also opens up the question of how many people who suffer from anxiety or depression, you know, might have some, how is memory involved in that? And I think that was one of the things that the person I spoke to who had this condition said, you know, that he'd met with a very few, I think there's under 20, I might be wrong about that, but there's not that many people who have actually been diagnosed with it. And all of them had sort of suffered from some form of, you know, depression or this sort of, you know, overwhelming inability to let go of things, which is kind of fascinating if you think about, you know, so many people, you know, might have a variation, at least, on this condition and not know about it. So it sort of, you know, gets you thinking about a lot of different things, I suppose.
And that's one theme that came out of this that was in a lot of these stories is this guy grew up thinking, oh, that's just me. And then he found out later, thanks to the internet, thanks to modern media, this is a thing. He could be diagnosed with the thing, and there are other people going through the same thing.
Right, that's right. And I mean, the girl with the phobia of throwing up, she just had no idea. I mean, she thought she was completely crazy. She was like, what, you know, what sort of person is scared of vomiting? It's like being scared of blowing your nose, you know, and it's like, I really, something's wrong with me. And it was, you know, she actually found a name for this condition that's, you know, I think, you know, one of the most common phobias in the world. It's just people just don't really talk about it because it's so embarrassing to say, I'm actually scared of vomiting. It's like, you know, I wonder, you know, yeah, it's possible she may have read about it in a magazine or, you know, maybe on a talk show, or, you know, or something, but, or heard it on the radio, but yeah, that she was actually able to find a name for her condition online and then tap into a network of a support network online is, you know, pretty was very empowering for her, and, you know, eventually sort of led her, I think, you know, to get some treatment that, you know, she hadn't even been offered it, although she'd been seeing therapists and psychologists her entire life, because she was just too scared to say out loud, even to them, you know, I'm scared of vomiting.
Well, and it's and people might think, oh, you know, you're just scared of this is a big thing. She structured her life to avoid the possibility of nausea. I mean, what
Absolutely.
She ate, what she did, where she went, how she traveled.
The
fifth most common phobia, I think you wrote in the piece.
Yeah, I think it's one of them. And I mean, these are sort of a continuum and sort of, you know, notoriously difficult to measure. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It was this sort of orb of anxiety that she created. It affects every aspect of her life in ways that you wouldn't even think about. And as you say, yeah, it's not just the fear of vomiting itself. It's actually more the fear of vomiting, so you don't want to feel sick ever. So she's doing everything she can from the second she wakes up to the second she goes to sleep, if she can get to sleep, for the fear, to avoid feeling nauseous, which is, you know, if you think about it, I mean, this is related to, you know, how you socialize, what you eat, you know, who you hang out with, where you go, what you do, how you work. It's kind of, you know, completely took over her life.
And the universal I took out of this, I mean, when I hear about anxiety, part of anxiety is the anxiety itself, and part of it is the fear that you'll be in an anxiety-producing situation. I mean, this is something going beyond this particular phobia that affects a lot of people.
Absolutely. And that avoidance, I think, is key to most, you know, I mean, anyone who suffers from anxiety will understand that. And it can manifest itself in so many ways, you know, and with a lot of the other subjects I talked to who may have had phobias or, you know, were plagued by obsessive thoughts. It's like, you know, just the sort of things that they would have to avoid to make themselves comfortable was definitely a key theme. And that really does mean limiting your life. So you can't really lead a full life because you're constantly scared of being scared. Which is, yeah, I think you're right. I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Well, we've talked about one that's kind of a mixed blessing, that memory, one that's clearly a negative, this phobia, one that viewed it as a positive, their unique situation, a genetic change that makes somebody only have to sleep 3-4 hours a night.
Yeah, that, which is absolutely fascinating. And she, and that woman is, you know, I mean, she's pretty incredible, the life that she leads. You know, I think when I was, every time I talked to her on the phone, she was, you know, she was either in a sports field somewhere or at the supermarket or driving kids around. So, you know, I mean, essentially, she's now a single mom. She takes in foster kids. And she works as a court reporter. It's like all these things that, you know, she leads such a full life. She packs so much into her into her day, and she can do that and function really highly with 3 hours sleep, I think, you know, sometimes two, and it's not always good sleep. Often she'll, you know, fall asleep on her sofa. And she didn't find out until, I think, maybe a year and a half ago, you know, that this is what she may have. You know, I mean, this gene has been found, I think, in only a couple of people, and there are those who are being studied, including her father, who he seems to think she has it worse than he does. But, you know, that they kind of grew up together and just thought, hey, this is just the way we are in our family. We just, for some reason, don't need any sleep, which is, you know, kind of fascinating. And she was, again, she was one that she did sort of see it as a negative, and then once she saw how it was, how other people responded to it, you know, she was like, God, I really do have this. This is a blessing. I'm like, so many people are jealous of me, especially people in New York. I can tell you that's the one. Everyone's like, my God, I wish I was her.
Well, we've just touched on a few of the stories that you tracked. Why is it important to bring attention to these stories? What do you hope we get out of reading these interviews?
Well, I think that the thing, for me at least, that I think is most important, and I think for the aim of the series as well, is that we just, you know, these sort of stripped back, bare, you know, what's and all tales of what it's like to live today, you know, may or may not have sort of been distorted or, you know, sort of taken over by more sensational formats or just kind of lost altogether. You know, the interviews are long and they're in depth and they really sort of get down to the nitty gritty. And I think that it's in those sort of you know, I think we call them, you know, like anthropologies by anecdote, and it's in those sort of, you know, they're anecdotal accounts, absolutely. They're not claiming to be representative of, you know, of everyone who may have one of these conditions or lead a life like these. But, you know, only by sort of, like, learning about these details do we promote understanding and discussion. And
it's a good place to leave it. Alexa, thank you so much for joining us today. That was Alexa Suli Ray, reporter for New York Magazine, with us to talk about her What It's Like series. And we've got a link to her cover story, Atypical, Life on the Margins of Experience, on the Central Time Facebook page.